Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip.
In this episode, Dr. Hope Christie meets Dr. Marina Bajidai, who is the director of the Active Learning Lab at Lancaster University, UK, where she is a lecturer in the Department of Psychology. She is a developmental scientist by training and earned her PhD in developmental psychology at Lancaster University, prior to which she obtained an EdM degree from the Harvard Graduate School of Education, BA and MA degrees from Belarus State University, worked as an educator, and held research positions at Harvard and Yale universities in the USA. She focuses on investigating knowledge acquisition, transformation, and transmission across development, as well as designing interventions to foster curiosity, wonder, and creativity.
Good morning, Marina. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I think we've got so much to talk about in terms of your really fascinating work, so I just want to jump right in. Anyone who's ever interacted with a baby or a very young child knows that they are innately curious beings. I think people often refer to them as little scientists, but I really like in an interview, I heard you refer to them as little anthropologists, which I thought was just brilliant. And one aspect of your research in the Active Learning Lab focuses on curiosity and knowledge acquisition in very young children and babies before they can even start communicating through speech. So before we talk about some of the findings of that work, can you give us a brief outline of how you work with children to investigate these aspects of their learning and development and kind of what technology you use?
Yes, good morning, Hope. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's exciting to talk about this field I'm working in, among many others who are pushing it forward and developing new questions and new technologies. And really, I just wanted to comment a little bit, I suppose, on the little scientist versus little anthropologist. It's not my invention, but I love it. It's given us an idea that children are not just independent learners, independent explorers. They do that in the social world, in the social realm. So, of course, they're constructing the knowledge of the world by playing world. And that's what Piaget, one of the developmental psychologists, would have said, that, you know, they're active explorers, they're little scientists. But then I had Vygotsky, who is another developmental psychologist historically, who embedded children in the social realm. So it's really important to keep that in mind. And some of my research focuses on that a lot. But yes, indeed. So they are actively exploring, not just independently, but through others, with the help of others and with others. Mm-hmm. So to do research in this field, we really need to give an opportunity for children to demonstrate what they can actively do. So how they actively learn. And that's why I've set up my lab to be called an Active Learning Lab.
Yeah.
But yeah, so of course, there are many different methodologies, many different ways we can study psychology, broadly speaking, developmental psychology and kind of curiosity, active learning and psychology. These range from experimental studies. So this is where we would bring our little participants, babies, for example, into the laboratory, and then we can create those rigorously controlled conditions. We can show them something on the screen or present them with some actual toys or have them meet different people, and we can see how they react, what they actually do, what sort of behaviors we can capture in those situations. So we create those situations and that will be an experiment. We can use different technologies within the experiment, like eye tracking, for example. And eye tracking has become quite popular and quite sort of easy to use due to technological advances. And that can be a screen-based eye tracking, where a child is looking at the screen and what they're looking at, how long they're looking at, how quickly they switch between different stimuli on the screen is captured, very fine-grained capturing. Or it can be what's called a head-mounted eye tracking, and that allows us to put the child in the, or an adult for that matter, I'm speaking about babies here, put them in a real more real interactive environment. So they don't have to stick to the screen and just watch what happens on the screen. They can play with actual toys or with actual real people. And we can see exactly what they're looking at, how long they're looking at, how quickly they switch. We can, of course, use neuro imaging methods with infants as well. That has come a long way. I don't personally use it, so I won't focus too much on it, but we do have EEG. We have FNIRs, you know, which are technologies that are quite baby friendly and also quite sensitive to what happens kind of under the hood in the brain.
Excellent.
Yeah. And I suppose I should mention the other methods as well. And there, no particular method is perfect or ideal or superior to others. So we can ask parents how their children are and give them a questionnaire or give them a kind of a longer maybe interview. And those sort of methodologies are hugely informative and they give us a lot of food for thought. And so it's not like experimental data is more accurate or rigorous than any other.
Well, coming from a mixed methodology background, that makes me happy to hear you say that it's nice to hear I can imagine the experimental data is really interesting and important. And like you say, technology must have come a long way because, you know, especially you'll know better than the babies can't tell you anything. So you really need to find other ways to see what they're looking at and how they're feeling. And I'm sure I'd heard in another interview you talk about kind of skin conductance and kind of physiological responses as well, because I'm sure you were saying something about putting the little cuff on their leg.
Yes, yeah. That was exciting. Again, that's an emerging technology for infancy researchers. A research, purposely built research tool is it's as simple as the wristwatch that mm-hmm. the adults wear, you know, to track our physiological responses or how many miles we walked. But this particular one was designed for research purposes and then we've been trying to use it with younger babies among other researchers in the world. So yes, we have attached that to the little chubby legs of the babies to get their heart rate and skin conductance response. It gives you other streams of data as well, and to see whether that gives us, yeah, like you say, something, some sort of data that babies can't give us behaviorally, or obviously they can't tell us. It's in development, I suppose, yes. this tool. I can't say, again, I'm coming back to the main point, no research tool is as advanced technologically as it is perfect. It's all, the most important thing is, what is the research question? What are you trying to find out? And then choosing the right method for that.
Lovely, thank you. And yeah, I mean, like you say, we'll come back to the research question. So you've conducted some absolutely fascinating studies, a series of studies to investigate how infants use their developmentally available communication skills to gain information from others in social learning contexts. And would you be able to tell us what you learned about how babies seek information from people who they consider to be reliable sources? And, you know, even before they can start talking, how do they do that?
Yes, exactly. So that was an interesting, challenging study to conduct. And we did use an experimental setup. So we invited these babies. They were 12 months, they were 1 year old, to our lab, and we fitted them with one of those head-mounted eye-tracking equipments I told you about. It's just a soft hat, and it has one camera that looks into the baby's eye and another camera that looks at the scene. And so that gave us a bit more fine-grained data. But the idea behind the study was to find out whether babies are not only sensitive to who is a good source of information in their social domain, but also whether they use that kind of understanding or knowledge of that sensitivity to help them. So here's how it worked. So babies are brought into the lab and they're seated at the table, have their head mounted eye tracker on, and they meet two people. And so one of these experimenters plays a role, both of them play a role. It's an experimental setup, so we are, you know, everyone has a role to play. One of those experimenters plays a role of an informative person. So they showing that they're knowledgeable about things, and things in baby's life is toys. So we put some toys on the table, and the person who's playing, the informative person, reliably labels the toy. Look, this is a ball. Or look, this is a car. Or some toys are unfamiliar, some kind of novel toys that don't really have a name, so it's common in our field to come up with nonsense words to label them. So you'd show them something completely strange and this informative person will say, oh, this is a Blicket, or it's a Toma, or yeah, it's a Modi. So they demonstrate that they know about toys and they can label them confidently and kind of in a nice interactive way. The other person that the child meets is equally nice, equally communicative, equally engaging, but they just don't know things. And they just, so they play this role of a non-informant, as we call them. They say, oh, wow, that's nice. Well, that's interesting. So they don't provide any information. So when it comes to familiar toys or unfamiliar toys, these two adults act very differently. And we know that children by this age, and this study also kind of confirmed that, that they are able to recognize that, they're able to encode that information, who is a knowledgeable person, who is not, who is competent, who is not, and so on. The novelty of this study I'm talking about was in the next phase, and the next phase was of the experiment procedure was where the child is faced with a question, a completely impossible question to answer, because they're presented with two completely novel toys, and they are asked, which one is the, and I'm given a nonsense word. They haven't seen the toys. They haven't heard this word before. There's no way to disambiguate. There's no way to answer this question. And then this complete silence for so many seconds. And then we're looking at who of these two adults that they've just met would they turn to? It's looking at one or the other, or longer at one, or more often at one or the other. It's taken as our kind of result. So the result is that they, babies at the age of one, turned to the informative, previously informative person. So they've not only encoded that this is an informative person, they've kind of turned to them for help when they needed information. And that's quite remarkable, because again, babies are not able to ask a question. They're not able to, you know, tell us what they recognize or not, but they, through these kind of really basic communicative behavior, such as turning to someone, you know, social looking, they're able to use the information that they know. We're not claiming that babies reflect on this, oh, this was an informative person or not, but in their behavior, we're able to show that kind of statistically that this is who they prefer to ask for help when needed.
That is fascinating to think that, yeah, there's, like you say, going on under the hood in their brain, they're able to kind of identify who is more informative, and then, like you say, at a later time asked about something, they can turn to that person again and say, and especially as well someone who they've just met, because I feel like as well, I mean, we'll not open the can of worms that is attachment theory, but do you know, like, it's not a caregiver, it's someone they've just met, and still they're able to encode that this person is a reliable informant.
And that was an important consideration, exactly that too, as we were designing what happens during the procedure. And I kind of briefly told you about, but there were so many things that we
found. Oh, I'm sure.
And indeed, we wanted to have these people as unfamiliar to them, because there's so many additional kind of variables or additional information that the caregiver brings with them.
Yeah.
Indeed. But yeah.
Yeah, it was so interesting. And if we speak a bit more about the caregiver of the child, so in terms of those findings that you had from that really interesting study, if we take those findings and say, what advice would you give to parents, or how can parents support active information seeking in babies and young children?
Yeah, it's an important question, because, you know, parents who are engaged in kind of child development findings and research, they always want some kind of sense of direction of what should I be doing. And I think I'd rephrase this really to say that what should parents not do to the curiosity? Children are naturally curious. They would explore, they do learn. And of course, we can scaffold this curiosity. We can give opportunities for that, or we can use particular probes or prompts, and we can encourage that, and we should as parents, but we should also not step in too much, and we should give that space and time for them to be maybe even bored and not bombarded with all kinds of information. Oh, look at this, or look at that, look at this toy.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, maybe this one plays a sound. So it's a bit of an interesting kind of dilemma, is you want to provide children with what's called cue-rich environments. So you want them to have access to variability in the environments. Different toys, different books, different, I don't know, nature-based kind of, you know, take them to the zoo and all of those activities, all of those environments allow them to see something new, and that would naturally bring them to wondering and asking questions maybe about it and developing some interests. But we should also not kind of overwhelm ourselves as parents with buying educational toys or any particularly. And yeah, I'm sure toy companies would love to see that this works. And I'm not aware of any conclusive research that shows that particular toys or any kind of educational toys are better than non-educational toys. Sorry to say.
You'll have all the toy companies coming after you now. But I mean, that's actually such a good point, though, because I think especially nowadays, a lot of toy companies will market, especially ones that maybe do everything that help with 1, 2, 3, ABC, that light up, that make noises. All these things are marketed as educational toys for children. But, you know, what you're saying is actually, you know, parents themselves don't need to buy the latest educational toy, more so just encourage that curiosity naturally. Like you say, maybe go to the zoo, go to the park outside, or, you know, playing with toys in the house.
Yes, I wouldn't say don't buy those toys. Yeah. By all means, they have a purpose, and especially if they're teaching a particular skill, like you just mentioned, you know, numerical thinking or some words. With that said, even though in those domains, as far as I'm aware, this is not my field of expertise, but even in those domains, natural social interaction is far superior to any kind of technological. At this very early stage, I'm not talking about infants here, but yes, now being attuned to your child's natural interests, giving them those opportunities to develop those natural interests, but also paying attention to their individual differences, their temperament, their how they go about interacting with the world, and not pushing them to do something that's uncomfortable to them, but when they are interested, giving them that space.
No, that's perfect. And I think you very briefly touched on it, but I just would like to clarify in terms of what behaviours might inhibit curiosity in children. So I know you mentioned briefly there, kind of from a parent or caregiver perspective, not bombarding them with information and kind of giving them space to kind of naturally, I suppose, attune to one thing or another. But is there anything else maybe that you could say that maybe wouldn't, what we could do to not inhibit curiosity in children?
Right, so since we are talking about research basis for advice, one finding that seems to be emerging and confirmed through several studies is that the overuse of teaching or instruction seems to inhibit further exploration. So these are the sort of studies where, and I just mentioned my study where we had an informative person and a non-informative person, right? And so imagine if you had this informative person kind of demonstrating their competence and knowledge and saying, this is how we do things. This is what it's called. This is how it works. This is how you play with the toy. This is where you press, and kind of giving those extensive and explicit kind of instructions in the experimental setting with young children, it has been shown to then impede further exploration. So children, and this can be interpreted loosely as children kind of taking it as the way to do things.
Okay.
Taken it as the final kind of knowledge, the final state of the art of the knowledge on this particular toy. And so maybe there's no point in exploring any further. So maybe not allowing for that to happen is one kind of piece of advice.
Perfect. That's great. Thank you so much. And your work is also, or some of your other work is focused on this concept of wonder. And can you explain what you mean by that and how you measure it and why it might be a desirable state for a child's learning?
Yes, that has become quite a focus of my research in the past few years as I moved from curiosity to wonder. And it's important to understand the differences between them. And especially we've been talking about infants and their young babies. We're going to move now to slightly older children because we really have no way at the moment to measure wonder in very young babies. We can speculate as to what it might look like, but we really don't have any single measure. And what I'm working on right now with my colleagues is a measure of wonder in school-age children. So what we mean by wand is kind of in comparison to curiosity specifically, that's quite useful because curiosity is mostly information seeking. We've been using this term of that active exploration, asking questions, like doing something very specific to obtain information and maybe close the information gap. I don't know something. I acquire the information. I close the gap. Now I know. So go from not knowing to knowing. Whereas wonder has this added layer of kind of emotional and reflective component, this very elusive state of, you know, some kind of wow response and questioning, you know, the unknown and maybe seeking explanations, not to get the right answer, but seeking explanation to go further, go deeper. So, yes. So it's much more kind of puzzling phenomenon, and wonder itself allows us to puzzle and to engage in this transcending something, being surprised, being astonished. So there's so many synonyms you can use to describe that. It's quite vague, isn't it? So
yeah.
It's part of our emotional and mental states. And so just because we can't pinpoint it very easily, unlike with curiosity, it's a bit easier to be like, well, the person is curious because they've asked so many questions. So the person is curious, they went on Wikipedia to find out the answer, or they've read an encyclopedia. With wonder, it's like, how do you know it happens? But it does happen. We all know it. So as researchers, it presents a very interesting challenge to us.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I can imagine wonder is almost, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like another advanced kind of cognitive stage where, like you say, you're going beyond just fact finding or seeking. You now want to explore and not so much get from A to B in terms of, I don't know the information, now I do, but more kind of explore around it and kind of, like you say, dive deeper and kind of explore that on a whole new level, which I can imagine isn't so much a cognitive state in babies, but maybe as they get older, then they kind of start to be more wondrous.
You know, it's a very good question, and it's an open question at the moment. I really can't tell whether babies' minds wonder.
Yeah.
And the wonder. Both, actually. Mind wondering is actually another quite fascinating field, but let's not go too far. Yeah, no, they say wonder is an experience, whereas curiosity is a bit more kind of a behavioral and informational. If we want to be really distinguishing them, a lot of people would use wonder and curiosity as synonyms as well. But I wouldn't say that we know or don't, we just don't know what babies do. And if we could have some kind of a magic tool that would, you know, pinpoint this is wonder, maybe it's a combination, you know, we sometimes develop kind of markers of particular states, like we were mentioning, skin conductance, heart rate, and I don't know, brain signature in alpha waves. If there was a combination of different measures that will say, oh, this is a state of wonder, that would be fascinating. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, definitely.
Not an easy concept to define and not an easy concept to measure.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to say, so, you know, difficult to define, difficult to measure. So how do you go about even trying to measure it?
Yeah. So what my colleagues from the Netherlands have developed, and we are currently finalizing our research in the UK, is a measure called a wonder chart. And so they've in the Netherlands have worked with over 700 children between the ages of 9 and 12. We've worked with over 400 children of the same ages here. We have quite a lot of data. So all these children were participants in the study to develop this tool, this measure. And the measure is actually not complicated per se, but it seems to be working really well, statistically speaking, psychometrically speaking. It's a good quantitative measure of wonder. And so what it is comprised of are 10 different prompts, different ways of probing a state of wonder in children, and children then respond, they provide a self-report, they respond to a set of questions. So for example, they're shown some videos or they are shown some stories, like little vignettes, you know, this has happened or that has happened. How would you feel about that? And then through these probing questions about how would you feel, we calculate what we call a wonder index. And so, doing the kind of the validation procedures in this research has led us to now conclude that this is a solid measure of wonder, and it's distinct from, say, curiosity.
Wow, how interesting. A wonder index sounds quite nice as well. a nice term. And you mentioned there in the about the measure in terms of probing questions. And so I was curious about how can adults or parents or teachers then start to kind of support children's wonder?
Mm-hmm. This, you know, goes again beyond curiosity, but you just would expose them to an opportunity to gain information. Here you would allow them an opportunity to not just be exposed to various phenomena, maybe going stargazing or going to Grand Canyon or something like that, but giving those probes for reflection. So one day is, at least in verbal in children, those who can have the metacognitive capacity to reflect, providing those kind of probes, you know, what do you think? What, you know, how do you think that has happened? You know, what does it make you consider? You know, how do you connect this to something else? So giving that perspective, probing the space of the possible, as my colleagues in the field have linked wonder to the space of possibility, you kind of pushing the boundaries of what is known, because when you just know what you know, you are within closed schema, you're within a closed set of answers, you can push further. This is where wonder happens.
Yeah, no, I like that term you said, kind of probing the space of possible. I think that's a really nice way to define it. And one of your other papers, you note things like playfulness, open-mindedness, and thinking outside the box describe a desirable and highly regarded state that children naturally engage in and most adults desperately crave. When thinking about creativity in the context of young children, what do we mean by it and how do young children tend to engage in creative expression?
Just like curiosity and wonder, creativity, yeah. Yes, yet another really fascinating and very elusive concept, isn't yeah. it? So I think it's important to kind of define what we mean by creativity and then to try to pinpoint what do creative behaviors and how does creativity manifest itself in very young children. And so one view to think about creativity is, well, some people say, you know, it's creative when you see it. You know it's creative when you kind of experience that. That's a bit sure, but again, how do we define it? Another approach is to think of creativity as having two components, and one of which is something really original, novel, unusual, but another one, something quite appropriate and valuable to the problem at hand. So let's just think of a child, going back to kind of young children, and they're playing with some blocks. It's not name. So let's just say they have step-by-step instructions. You know, you put this block on top of this one, and then you add this one, little one. So they can follow this process and create something, but it will not be creative just because there's no novelty to it, right? And then we can think of an opposite example. They took all these blocks and they just kind of, I don't know, threw it into a pile and walked away. And that's novel,
yeah.
But that's not particularly creative either. Not because there's not a thing that was made, but just because there was no meaning to it. It wasn't valuable, right? So it's that creativity is that sort of sweet spot between where originality and meaningfulness or valuableness comes into play. So thinking again, children can express creativity by creating something in the space with the materials provided. It doesn't have to be profound. It doesn't have to be an artistic expression per se. It could be, and that's great. But I, along with others, think of creativity as a process, as a cognitive process, again, just like curiosity and wonder. It's something that we are all capable of. It's not that there are creative people and uncreative people or creatives, as they say. Everyone has creativity as a way of engaging with the world. So it's a process of forming unusual associations, of, you know, transforming something that's familiar into something novel, of coming up with multiple solutions, making some kind of combinations or modifications that no one has thought of. And it can be as simple, it can be as grand as you wish. That's just the magnitude. So I don't know if I diverted from the question.
No, that was perfect. That was such a nice answer.
It happens in everyday life, even with very young children.
But I think that's such a nice answer, because I think even speaking as my own lay understanding of creativity and things, you would liken that to, like you say, it doesn't have to be something grand. If you think, you know, like, oh, children naturally take to drawing or painting or are naturally gifted with music or things, and you think like, oh, they're really creative because they're channeling that. And then, but actually the message that you're saying is actually it's in all of us. All children are creative, and it doesn't have to be this big grand expression. It can actually be just doing something in a novel or different way.
And I deeply believe in that, really. It's what we call everyday creativity. Yeah. Or in some other literature, they have come up with an idea of little C as a little creativity versus big C as a that kind of, you know, Mozart. Creativity. But again, creativity can manifest itself in very different ways. For us, we can be creative when cooking, when, you know, babysitting. We can be creative in everyday activity. And it's great if we can develop that creativity in our kind of professional in occupation. But sometimes we don't, but we express it in other ways in different domains. And I think that's really simple but profound to me.
Yeah. No, I think, again, like I say, a really lovely message for kind of parents and teachers, that actually that everyday creativity is there for everybody. And what do we know about, or from the research, about different effects of explicit teaching instructions or intrinsically driven or spontaneous information seeking, and how that can affect children's creativity?
Yeah, I sort of touched, I suppose, you know, thinking about how explicit pedagogical instruction, that kind of like, this is how you do it. Think about it in terms of creativity. Here's the drawing sheet, and, you know, the sky is blue and the sun is yellow and the grass is green. That kind of level of instruction is going to limit child's creativity for most children. Some will still disobey the rules and paint the, you know, the sky not just blue, but maybe blue with pink, with purple. And I'm using really simple examples here, but I think that gets the message across, is that explicit pedagogy, explicit, you know, kind of rules in the block playing example, you know, explicit instructions, you know, put this little one, it must be yellow, not white, and then you put it on. So that's good for other things, that sort of instructions. But for creativity, it's good to give space and open that space of possibility and let children be creating the opportunities for themselves, really. So, but in terms of kind of the effect of curiosity or spontaneous information seeking for the sake of information on creativity, that's actually a really underexplored, surprisingly underexplored area of research, which, you know, we in our field are trying to kind of tap into and progress there, because we really don't have any conclusive evidence that greater curiosity leads to greater creativity. There are some tangentially related findings that can point in a direction, or theoretically it seems to make sense. If you're more curious, you'd be more creative, but really kind of empirically speaking, we are lacking that support, and there's a lot of work to be done there.
Excellent, thank you. And I know I kind of briefly mentioned it there just now, and we do often associate things like art with creativity, but what does the research say about links between the two of them?
Well, obviously art is a creative activity. It's one of the, you know, natural environments to allow for creative expression, and we can think of art broadly, visual art, musical arts, literally arts, you know, poems, dancing, and so on. And that, you know, it's not to be denied that someone engaging in artistic domain does something creative. But I think going back to this idea of everyday creativity, is as the most important finding is you can develop these creative processes, skills, and take them to other domains. So if art is allowing one to develop these skills, and then they can take it at anywhere, these are transferable skills. So yeah, that's why engaging with the art, there's a lot of research on how art is beneficial for creativity. So the links are very clear, but I think, you know, taking that to other aspects of life and not thinking of, oh, if I don't paint, then I probably am not a creative individual.
Yeah.
I think that's the big kind of societal change, attitudinal change that we would like to implement.
Well, that's nice to hear, because I couldn't draw for any amount of money in the world. So I would naturally say my creativity is quite low, but nice to hear that actually I could maybe be creative in other ways.
Most of us do think that. And again, you know, going back to kind of advice for parents, for adults working with children, is that just because the child doesn't want to draw or doesn't want to dance or doesn't want to play a musical instrument, that doesn't mean that they will not be creative. They can be creative in very unexpected ways. They can creatively rearrange their toys on the shelf, or I don't know, can creatively play with the ball or walk their dog. And providing opportunities for engagement with the art, for appreciating the art, but also like doing something artistic is wonderful and it's great and it's important, but we shouldn't overemphasize that, thinking that, you know, if the child doesn't engage with it, then that they're going to be lagging behind on their creativity skills.
No, I think that's a really important message. And I know you touched on a few things there, but is there any other things that families can do or what we can do in family life to help promote children's creativity?
Yeah, well, right, you know, the things I was saying. But I think in addition to that, I can say also kind of research sort of based, bringing it back to what we know. We do know that scaffolding creativity can work. So scaffolding as in modeling it socially. So if you are yourself allowing for creativity to be present in your life and showing that to your child, it's the same thing when we say, how do we make children read more? Well, show them that you are reading as well.
Yeah.
Reading, they might actually pick up reading because they, you know, they look up to you as parents, as adults in their life. They're very full of trust and full of kind of innate respect for others, if you will. So the same thing here with curiosity, with creativity, with wonder. If you are allowing those things in your life and you're demonstrating that this enhances you, it allows you to flourish, it allows you to experience life in deeper ways, then show that to your children, show that, model it. And yes, this research rigorously in kind of controlled, rigorous experimental conditions showing that being more creative, you know, coming up with more ideas, transfers to the child, kind of modeling that behavior.
Lovely. And what bearing do you think research in this area should have, if any, on the way academic subjects are taught in school, for example? I know a few years ago that you were involved in a study that looked at high school students' levels of interest and intention to persist in academic and creative challenges. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what you found there.
Yeah, maybe sort of briefly, that this research was led by my collaborators at the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence. So it was really interesting. What we did is we had high school students, so quite kind of almost adults, tell us about their challenges that they perceive, how they perceive challenges in two domains, in a kind of creative domain, as we were just saying, you know, all the artistic things, but also academic. And so they had like open-ended challenge expression prompts, you know, can you describe your challenge, you know, in your own words? And then we've coded those little stories that children, young people wrote to identify what was different between when they spoke about creative kind of domain and academic domain. Most importantly, what we found is that it was this interest, this level of, I don't know, passion and desire to accomplish these things that was distinguishing them. So when participants were writing about their creative challenges, and they expressed more interest in it to persist and actually overcome those challenges. And when that interest was lacking, it was lacking mostly in academic kind of domain. So from that, and from many other studies in this field, really, you know, allowing for academic environments, school environments, for children to develop that interest, that passion, that curiosity about what they're doing, seems to have an effect on whether they will persist and accomplish things and do well. So practitioners, educators really know that. They do know that intrinsic motivation, interest, curiosity to learn leads to better learning outcomes. But really conclusive research seems to be lagging behind. So we really want to develop that empirical base so we can influence the policy and, you know, the top-down guidelines for educators.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think obviously there's just the kind of key curriculum that, you know, and it's like you say, it's that very instructional based kind of approach where you need to learn this, this and this in order to progress, and there's no kind of deviation around that. So yeah,
there's no time for
that's it.
If you talk to any teachers, and I do talk to quite a lot of teachers these days, who tell me exactly that, that's great. We'd love to offer these opportunities for wonder and creativity. We just don't have the time and space, and we are not kind of allowed because we must deliver, and that is scary.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, like you say, I think there hopefully in the future will be some more, well, I suppose not concrete, but like more conclusive evidence that can maybe.
That's what we need. We need strong evidence base as a field to bring it to those people in charge of curriculum based decisions, so that these decisions can then kind of make a full circle from evidence all the way to the top and all the way to the actual practitioners, you know, actually teaching our children.
Amazing. Well, if you've got any spare time, Marina, then you could get started on that next.
Every little helps. Every study, you know, no single published study can have that effect. But you know, accumulating evidence from many, you know, psychology and any sciences is a really collaborative endeavor. You don't do something by yourself. And as we accumulate this evidence, I'm sure. This hope things will change.
And what about the relationship between creativity and emotions? And what do we know about how creative tasks can contribute to young people's emotional literacy?
Right. Well, that's another big question and lots of people working on it. I've mentioned Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence, where I've worked for a few years, and Zorana Ivcevic there is really the leading person on that. And so what I worked on with her and others is showing that creativity and emotion skills are intricately linked, really. And so by engaging in one, say, creative kind of expression, you're also developing your emotional skills. And both sets of skills have been shown to positively impact all our kind of range of good life outcomes, you know, from achievement to well-being, really. So, but you know, art and emotional lives, or any creative pursuits and emotional lives are really connected. You know, if we talk about art, that allows us to get in touch with our emotions, but also elicits emotions, but also allows us to express emotions. So from appreciating to actually doing something creative through the arts specifically, that builds our kind of emotional capacity.
Lovely. No, that's really great. And I think you're working on a survey just now. I don't know, it might have been the one you were mentioning about the Wonder Index, but the survey that will measure children's wonder, curiosity, creativity and personality. So can you tell us a little bit about that piece of work and where it's up to currently?
Yeah, so that was the Wonder Chart, Wonder Index I was mentioning. We've actually completed the data collection. We have analyzed the data. We're in the process of publishing this. So in a sense, the main goal of this was quite pragmatic, is to develop that measure, to validate it. And so we can confidently then use it for other studies. And so we have accomplished that goal. It does have, the measure has good statistical properties. It can adequately capture children's wonder as they self-report it through these kind of. It also showed that, you know, kind of a good thing about it, showed that it's uniquely capturing wonder as compared to other emotions. So we had other questions, so it's called discriminant validity. We can discriminate with this measure that this is actually capturing wonder and not happiness or sadness or some other kind of emotion. So yeah, in other words, we are kind of confident we can measure it with this scale. Some other interesting, more inconclusive findings emerged from our research is that, so we had this wonder measure and it was associated with some measures that are relevant to it, but not others. So we're kind of trying to make sense of that, because interestingly, so wonder, being, you know, wondering about something, was associated with desire to resolve uncertainty. So when you're curious about something and you want to kind of figure out why, it was associated with that. And that's great, and it seems to make sense, and was distinct but associated with it. It was associated, wonder was associated with kind of self-held positive attitudes towards being, curious and towards wondering. So again, this was on a self-report basis. So children were asked, how much do you agree or disagree with statements, for example, like, and it's important to wonder about lots of things because I can learn about lots of things, roughly speaking. So they've kind of self-reflected, it's important, and they've experienced more wonder. And so with some other kind of measures, but also this wonder chart wasn't associated with, for example, their performance, children's performance on the creativity task. So we had them do a task where they have to generate novel ideas, novel uses for a particular object. It's a standard task called the divergent thinking or unusual uses test. You are given a prompt, think of new uses for a box or for a brick. And you're just given time to come up with new solutions. So we did that, and we didn't find that actual behavior expressing creative thinking in this way was associated with wonder. So that was somewhat unexpected, and we're trying to make sense of it. That brings a lot of questions, and that gives us a lot of work to do in the future, really. Yeah.
Amazing. And I know that you were saying the wonder chart, the goal was to obviously create it, to validate it, make sure it's reliable and that other people can have access. And do you and your colleagues have any plans for what you would like to do now in the future with that wonder chart?
So yeah, so the one thing definitely is to, because I was saying, theoretically, we think that curiosity, wonder and creativity, there's a link between them, but empirically, we really don't know what that link is. And I think the reason why we don't know, one of the reasons is that we're lacking those adequate and good measures in all three domains, in curiosity, in wonder, and in creativity. Creativity has the longest kind of the body of research that was accumulated over the longer period. And yet people working in this field still argue what's the best way of measuring it. And we don't have time to go into all of that. Wonder had no measures whatsoever. So this will be the first measure in children. Really. So we have that. And then, you know, curiosity is another big topic in terms of measurement. So what we're working on at the moment is developing a assessment tool that will be a kind of multidimensional, that will try to capture curiosity from different perspectives. Because you can think of curiosity as, oh, it's the number of questions someone asks when they want to find out. Or it can be, oh, it's that self-report, is that kind of the attitudes and the beliefs one holds about being curious. Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? That's a very different way of thinking of curiosity. Or it can be, seeking information from multiple sources, and we can create a task that does that, but it only captures curiosity from that particular perspective. So what we're trying to do is integrate all these different conceptualizations of curiosity and create a multidimensional battery of curiosity scales that can be used for this sort of research. So what we want to do is have reliable measures of all concepts that we can see how they relate to each other, these concepts, also what kind of predictive value they have on, as I say, good life outcomes, academic achievement, you know, satisfaction with life, well-being, psychologically speaking, having meaning in life, and these sorts of domains.
Excellent. And I think this might be the answer to my question, which was, you know, finally, what interest and projects are you working on at the moment? But I imagine that the creating those battery of assessments has probably taken up most of your time.
This is one of the main areas, the main focus, really. We are also working on experimental studies, and just take a moment to mention it, I suppose.
Of course. Yes, please.
In addition to this kind of multidimensional battery, we also we go back to infants, and we're doing a set of studies in our lab where we want to, in a really kind of controlled environment, to look at whether curiosity as expressed by infants about, well, under the age of two, very young infants, whether that has any bearing on how well they learn something. So in these studies, we're using eye tracking paradigm where the children are looking at the screen, and they're able to trigger something on the screen just based on their gaze. So it's called the gaze contingent eye tracking. So if I'm looking on this toy, this toy will be triggered and they will learn something about the toy, like what it's called, for example. But if I'm looking at this one, then I will trigger this. So what we're trying to show or to find out is really, does that self-driven learning, does triggering something to learn about it then transpire in better memory of that label, as opposed to when you're shown the same exact toys, but you have no agency, you have no way of guiding your own learning through your curiosity. And these studies are quite challenging. Methodologically speaking, these are young babies. They don't really want to sit in front of the screen for a long time.
Yeah,
that's another kind of line of research we are pursuing.
Fantastic. That all sounds really, really interesting. And maybe once some time has passed, we can have you back to tell us about how you've conquered the battery of all measures of wonder, curiosity and creativity, as well as hearing about the eye tracking study, because that sounds really interesting.
Yes, that would be great.
Amazing.
Answers to these questions.
Well, thank you very much, Marina. It's been so lovely to speak to you this morning. I've personally learned a lot, so thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.